Welcome to the Daily Objective. I am your host today, Don Watkins, and here with me is author, former writing coach client of mine, and all-around awesome guy, Mark Moses. Hey, Mark, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Don. Thanks.
All right. So, Mark, you, in the last year or so, maybe a little bit more now, have a book published by Palgrave Macmillan, the municipal, I almost said the munificent, Financial Crisis, a framework for understanding and fixing government budgeting. And I'm very happy to say that I played a small role in helping you create this. And it was actually put out by the publisher of my first book with Yaron Brook, Free Market Revolution. And I want to kind of get into the story of how you got there and some of the background that led you to write the book and some of the lessons you've learned around along the way. But I'm curious just to start with, like, how does it feel? How did it feel like holding that book in your hand the first time? And how has it felt since then just trying to get it out there and get it read?
Well, I have to say, during the writing process, I really learned how much discipline and motivation one needs to write a book. And so, yeah, when I held the book in my hand and was kind of in that category of published author, it felt great. It was a real accomplishment. And it's something that has been a great conversation starter. It's been a great introduction to meet people I never would have met had it not been for the book. And it, when I look at the cover, it just instantly brings all that back, that a lot of that struggle and pain was well worth it.
Yeah. So let's dive into that. But before we do, maybe say a little bit about your background, because you haven't spent your life writing books and trying to influence people in the realm of ideas. Maybe say a little bit about your career, but also I'd like to hear at least a few words and sort of how you got interested in objectivism, because I mean, that's how I think you learned about me and how we got to know each other.
Right. Well, when I was in my mid-teens, my father started reading Ayn Rand, and he subscribed to the Ayn Rand letter at the time. And so we developed in our house a small library of Ayn Rand's books. I think I was in my mid-teens. I picked up The Virtue of Selfishness and was struck by the clarity of the writing. I wound up reading Atlas Shrugged when I was around 16. And that was just an experience. It was the first book I'd ever read that moved me and got me thinking so much. And so in my late teens, I think I was a senior in high school. I don't even think I was driving long distances then. My father drove me down to the Stanford campus and I listened to the tape lectures of Leonard Peikoff had distributed at the time. And so by the time I was finished with college, I think I'd read just about almost everything there was that was out there. But my interest was not really in academics and philosophy. I was an engineering major in school. So I kind of plateaued a bit. Also, I didn't have a lot of life experience, and there wasn't OPAR at the time or understanding of objectivism at the time. So I think without my life experience, I overestimated how much I could just be carried by listening and reading and not really thinking things through and applying them in practice. And so I went on to have a early career in banking and real estate investments. Later, I got into local government in the finance and administrative area. And that's really where I spent the bulk of my career in the last 30 years of my career. And then just kind of transitioning into the motivation to write the book. With the earlier philosophic understanding, and also I think I'd read Economics in One Lesson when I was about 20 years old, I was just appalled at the at the way decisions were made in local government, the style of decision making, the culture, the ignorance of economics in action. And so I guess it was about 14, 15 years ago, I was having dinner with Jeff Britting, you know, the archivist for the Ayn Rand Institute. He was a college friend of mine. In fact, just backing up, he and I were the only two people out of 30,000 at the University of California, Berkeley campus around 1980 who were taking Dr. Peikoff's courses that were available at the time. So he listened to me talk about what was going on with me professionally. And he said, you know, you really ought to write. And I didn't get what he was saying at the time. He was had much better vision of what was possible and how I could link my philosophic interests and what I was seeing kind of on the job in local government. And then when Alex Epstein came up with the moral case for fossil fuels, I saw, oh, wow, this is how you can really apply principles to a specific area. And I started to get a little more. And then there was a 2016 OCON session that I didn't attend, but I later saw on YouTube, How Books Propel a Philosophic Movement, with the Longiorno, Steve Simpson, and some other guy. Oh, I guess that your own book, Rook and You. And that really solidified for me, oh, wow, a book really can have an impact. I really do have a book in me and a perspective, and somebody's going to write something like this someday, and why not me? And so from there, I started organizing around the writing process and having enough time to devote to the writing. And then when the pandemic hit, all of a sudden with the lockdown, I totally pivoted and said, okay, if I can't go out and can't have dinner and can't go anywhere, I'm going to finish this book. And so it was right around the time that you were available for some writing consulting. And I jumped on that as fast as I possibly could to get in front of you on that. And that really was the, you know, summer, fall of 2020, where I did the major writing. You helped with my proposal to Palgrave Macmillan, which was a success and an amazing thing. I mean, that's just one of those once in a lifetime kind of situations where here I was with no track record, no following, and I got an international publisher to publish my book.
Yeah. So let's, there's a couple things I want to highlight. So first we should just definitely say, you mentioned Jeff Britting, our mutual friend, awesome archivist. I had him on my podcast on the Don Watkins Show. But he also was a major, major help, both at, as you say, inspiring the book, but also in the editing. So all credit to Jeff for his contribution.
He was a major, I mean, he's just been a major supporter of mine over decades. So, yeah.
I want to say a few things about the book myself. And I think later on we can come back and maybe delve into the ideas a little bit more. But and I've told you this before, what I find really striking about the book is, so first of all, it's written by an insider. But what it really is if you think of most analyses of the way that bureaucracies work and malfunction and could function properly if they had a kind of correct approach. It you're seeing it at the local level, but the thing that I found really striking is you see how kind of common ideas in the free market world about, you know, lack of information, distortive incentives, you see how they actually play out in real life at a really concretized level. So instead of just having a, you know, government can't do anything right and things get messed up and they don't know how to spend money, like you see the actual causality at a really deep level. And so I walked away from working on and reading the book with just so much more clarity on exactly like, how do governments go wrong? Why do they go wrong this way? How could they function better? That even somebody who's like very familiar with free market ideas and free market economics, I think there's a lot they can get out of the book. Now, that's not the main topic of your book. That's sort of part of the explanation. The main topic of your book is kind of municipal financial crises and the kind of messes that they've got themselves into. But even for somebody who thinks, yeah, I'm not interested in that, which I think it's actually fascinating topic, I want to highlight, like, this book will really help you just at the level of, if you want to understand politics and economics better, I think there's just a lot of stuff in here that you won't find anywhere else.
Yeah, thanks. And, you know, I really try to write it in a way that is positive. It's not just bashing the status quo. It's presenting a positive vision of how these problems can be solved. And it should be general enough, even though it's based on local government, because that's where my professional experience is. It's applicable to regional government, state government, national government, and even some of the basics of, I mean, part of the theme of the book is that it's impossible to successfully manage or budget for an amorphous organization, you know, and our cities have no real identity. It's made up from week to week, or council meeting to council meeting. And so it really makes a mockery out of management and budgeting. And that's a lesson that I think, well, it's applicable in the corporate world as well. If you can't decide what it is you are or what it is you're doing, you're going to suffer as an organization. And so
applicable in the ethical world too. If you think about what ethics is doing, it's saying you can't get by the seat of your pants. You need to have a defined purpose, a defined standard of value, principles that are governing your actions so that you can organize your life in a long-range fashion to actually achieve a worthwhile goal. And so you're really seeing play out at the level of systems and organizations, what the same thing that plays out at the level of the individual.
Yeah, absolutely. And and that's really what I saw year in and year out. And part of what the book allowed me to do was I watched my values trampled on, and I watched in frustration just a lot of poor decision making and poor approach to administering the organizations and defining them. And so the book gave me an opportunity to channel that into something positive, leave something on the table in terms of, if you're serious about solving this problem, there is a solution. I think part of the culture in local government is that you're just resigned to ongoing scarcity, ongoing confusion, ongoing politics that is just an ongoing way of doing business. And from my perspective, somebody's got to step in and say, no, that doesn't really need to be the case.
So let's talk a little bit about writing more generally and how you're approaching it. So, all right, it's day one. You've been inspired to start this project. You haven't you've written in a work context before, but never anything like this, or at least, you know, maybe not since college. Perhaps there were letters.
I wasn't a big writer. I was an engineering major in college, and I tested out of the basic English. So I did almost no writing in college.
All right. So this is something new. You have as an inspiration what Alex did. Pretty intimidating. It was intimidating to me, and I had already written several books when that came out. And I said, how do I take the lessons and run with them? You sit down day one. How did you even start?
Well, and this was part of my learning, because I knew enough to know that writing a 200-page book is not just like writing 10, 20-page staff reports, that it's a very different kind of thing. But I was still confused in the beginning. And in terms of, I thought I was writing, and I was really just thinking on paper. Mm-hmm. Or I thought I was writing, but I would catch myself just venting. And so, you know,
sorry to interrupt you, but I think the distinction is important. So the way I put it is, writing is communication. It's not any time you put words on a page. Sometimes you're putting words on a page to clarify your own thinking, but communication is, I'm actually trying to connect with another mind and get them to understand something from my context. And so I take it that that's what you're talking about. You realize I thought I was communicating, but that's not at all what I was doing.
Exactly. And so there were a lot of words on paper. Some of it I thought was pretty good. Some of it I looked at later, like, why is this here? And I mean, that was through a lot of your help. I learned that to keep some level of attention on the audience that who you're writing for, and that you really have to write in a way where there's a flow and that each paragraph follows from the previous one and leads to the next one. And when I found myself going back and reading what I had written, I couldn't follow it. I couldn't tell you why something was placed in a certain way. And I figured, wait a minute, if I can't recreate why this is here, how is anybody on the outside going to have any kind of chance? And so that was a real struggle and a real learning that that it's not just getting words on paper. And the kind of reports I was used to writing were very disposable, right? They would be for a council meeting and then the council meeting would be over and it would go in the archives and no one would ever look at it again. Or maybe they look at it again to cut and paste on next year's report or something. But this was really something that was meant to stand on its own, communicate something objectively, and leave the reader with, you know, imparted knowledge, not, again, not just they've read all these words and they're guessing as to what's meant. And so that was a huge learning for me and a huge growth.
Yeah. I mean, that is a super common issue that you sit down to write and it's sort of like one idea leads you to the next idea, but not necessarily in a logical, purposeful way. It just suggests, oh, well, that reminds me of this, and this reminds me of that. And oh, I really want to talk about that. But what a book or any act of communication is you have an overriding purpose that, you know, you're formulating as a theme. This is the central idea I'm trying to get down. And the way I think about good writing is that it grabs you in the first sentence and then it propels you forward. And part of propels you forward is that each point flows out of the preceding point and feels like it's flowing necessarily out of the preceding point. We're talking about this not after we talked about that. We're talking about this because we talked about that. And one of the best, you know that you're really getting kind of the structure of a piece right when the reader's reaction is, oh, I have a question pop up in my mind. Oh, he's answering that question right now. Like that's
yeah,
really
that's
what
a feeling
after.
I've had. Yeah. And whenever I read a book like that, where I'm like, wait a minute, he's not thinking about this. And then yeah, two paragraphs later, it's answered. It's like, yeah, there's a writer who's really on track with the reader and what the likely questions are. And I guess I'll just say another huge learning was when I started the writing, I would say I had about 80 to 85% of the theme solidly in my head. I really hadn't worked out where it was going to end and how it was going to end. And that was something that developed as I was writing. And that is so much harder. And if I ever write another book, I'm going to go to that discipline of if you can't prepare an outline, start to finish, and know the theme, so you have a standard of judging what belongs, what doesn't belong. Because I had a lot of things that I just had to throw out because in the end, they didn't support the theme. They might be good blog material or they might be interesting points, but it was just writing that was not supporting the theme of the book. And so I would never venture in again to starting a book without knowing what the flow is going to be, what the theme is going to be, where it's going to start, where it's going to end. That is a painful process of untangling that once you get it on paper.
Yeah, although I have some bad news for you. That is what you say after writing your first book. After writing your second, third, fourth, fifth, what you realize is you can definitely save yourself a lot of heartache by really trying to get your outline as good as possible. But as you write, I have never seen a situation where there's not major changes in the structure, where you have to rethink a bunch of things, where you have to kind of go back and re-engineer it. Again, it's sort of like Peter Thiel's point about a business plan. He says, yeah, every business plan is worthless in the sense that you ultimately have to throw it out, but you need to do one because what it does is sharpen your thinking and put you in a better position so that when you throw things out and reorganize them, you're starting from a better place and you're more in control of being able to spot what's going wrong and so on. So I think it's very similar in writing. Look, hey, if you can pull it off, good for you. I've never been able to. But certainly the more work you do on the front end, the better and easier the back end is going to be, though it's rarely, rarely smooth. In part because there's it's very hard to, you'll learn a lot as you're writing, but it's very hard to anticipate like what a fleshed out point is really going to look like and what it's going to depend on. And so that, good luck in your second go around. I always have a fantasy when I start a book about it. This one, I'm going to get the outline right, but it has not yet happened. Well, cool. So what was like the turning point? Because I mean, I remember working with you, there really seemed to be, and it wasn't necessarily like a sharp one day, everything was different, but there did seem to be a point where suddenly like it felt like you had much more control over your writing and like you felt like you knew what you were doing and how to spot and fix errors in a way that when we started, for instance, it was just kind of like, yeah, I know this isn't right. I'm trying things out. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but who knows when. And I'm blindsided, you know, when Don points out problems. Do you have, looking back, do you have an inner sense of like when things really started to come together in your mind is, yeah, I kind of know what I'm doing now?
Well, it was very compressed in time because I think I had just barely gotten momentum going with you coaching me. Then all of a sudden, I had to pivot a little bit and work on the proposal for Palgrave. And that was just one of those, the opportunity was there. I couldn't just let it go and hope they would still be there in another year. And so I was simultaneously, this is in the fall of 2020, working with you on refining my writing skills. I was heavily motivated by the prospect of having a publisher, and I had to put together the 10 chapter summaries and the sample chapter for the publisher. So I think the focus on the chapter summaries helped me really review and revisit the theme of the book as a whole, and the book as a whole. And yeah, I don't know that there was really so much one point as much as I was so all in to the process and assimilating things as quickly as I could. And I guess I was having more good days than bad days instead of the reverse in terms of getting things on paper that were working.
But well, that definitely
a lot
was...
of it comes to the just taking the feedback in and trying to apply it. And you modeled some things for me in terms of how to structure things and how to keep the flow going that were just enormously helpful.
Well, let me. Well, there's two things that jump out there that I think will be helpful to others who are kind of going down this journey. So in terms of taking the feedback, I mean, one thing that was notable about you, and I think part of the reason you were able to grow so fast is I don't think I've ever met somebody better at taking criticism. I'm not the harshest at giving criticism, but I'm not the gentlest either, right? And for you, it was always, you were eager to get it and you didn't there was no defensiveness. There was always the view of it's a product that's being criticized, not me, Mark, the thinker and writer. And I think that's one reason you're able to take it in so much and go with it is you're just like, it's like being an engineer and somebody points out, hey, that material is not very good. Why don't you use this material? Like, yeah, that makes a lot more sense. You're not like, are you calling me somebody, you know, bad engineer or something? Like, that's not your mentality. And then the second thing that's more tactical, but I want people to get, so you did these kind of chapter summaries, chapter outline. But I think it was during that process or around the same time, one thing you did that is it scares a lot of people. It takes a lot of time. They don't want to do it, but it's really, really good. If we think about the one of the hardest parts about a book is, does the structure hang together and does it have that kind of necessary flow to it where each step follows from the next? You went through your entire draft and it's what we call reverse outlining it, right? You condensed, I don't know if you did it paragraph by paragraph, but okay, what's the key point here such that what you have at the end is an outline of your actual manuscript that would look like, you know, if you just came up with an outline to write your manuscript. But that is a, I've never actually done that with an entire book before. I probably should. But I, like when I saw you do that, A, I think you had a much more, like, I really see what's going on in this book in a way I didn't before perspective on it. But I was really impressed by that because like, that's like, I'm going to put in the work to make this good, even though it's not the most fun part of the work. So maybe you have some things to say about that.
That was one of those where there was just no choice in my mind. It was like, I have to do this. It's the only way to untangle some of those remnants of some of the earlier writing, because even though this writing, you know, wasn't stretched out over a decade, right? It was really only stretched out over a couple of years. Because of my growth, the writing was very different in terms of what I'd done early on compared to later. And I was also trying to manage, there's some technical chapters in the book where I wanted to be careful. Am I just diving down a rabbit hole and doing too much heavy lifting on something that really isn't necessary for the, given the theme of the book? And so there was just so much to untangle there. And, you know, it was kind of one of those things where, you know, you put it out there as a recommendation, not pushing it really hard, but just throwing it out there. And I thought, you know, I have to do this. It just is the only way to make sure there's a good, clean sweep through the book. And again, untangling some of the old writing problems and things that just didn't belong there. And it was kind of both it was a difficult process and somewhat tedious, but the satisfaction of dropping things that didn't really need to be there, knowing it was going to be a tighter book as a result, kept me going on that.
Yeah. And I mean, just to get, because people might think, well, if it's tedious and this long, like, why are you doing it? The deepest reason you could put in epistemological terms is the issue of the crow. So in objectivism, there's the idea of your mind can only hold so much in conscious awareness at once. And you can't remember the kind of logical chain of argument that you've been giving over the course of 20 pages, let alone 200. You can't hold that all in mind. And what you do when you turn it into a condensed outline is you can look back and say, oh, this point isn't needed. And oh, this point's needed here. You can think about the book as a total instead of just individual kinds of chunks. One thing we haven't talked about, so we talked about my contribution, Jeff's and so on. You were also taking or auditing ARI's, I think Keith Lockich's writing course at the time. I wonder if there's any insights you got from that you found particularly helpful.
Yeah, Keith is amazing. I was auditing the class, so I wasn't getting direct feedback from him. But just in looking at some of the other assignments and the comments that he made on them, I was taking all that in. And, you know, even though I was auditing, I had a working book in progress that I could immediately take what I was learning and apply it to. And again, this was a very intense time because, yeah, I'm listening to Keith talk about things and evaluate papers, working with you, getting a proposal out to the publisher, and dealing with this kind of growth spurt in terms of the writing and what that meant for the content of the manuscript draft. And so, but I will say the ARU involvement was a deliberate part of my process here because I wanted to sharpen my thinking skills. I wanted to go back. It forced me to go back and reread things I hadn't read literally for four decades. And it sharpened my thinking, sharpened my writing, and was a huge contributor to the process. And so I'm in my fourth year of auditing for the ARU courses, and it's been enormous growth. And just mention one other thing in that regard, the standard kind of thing is, right, you read Ayn Rand when you're young and then you grow up and grow away from it. But I had a few decades where I wasn't intensely involved. I was reading things as they came out, Ominous Parallels and Harry Benswanger's How We Know, but I wasn't really intensely involved in OCONs until a few years ago. And with the whole surge of available content on the internet, it made it easier to re-engage with the ideas, sharpen all that. But the ARU courses have been huge in terms of helping me get in this mindset of thinking more like an intellectual, understanding arguments, understanding communication at a level that was kind of on automatic pilot for a few decades there as I was working, especially when I was working in local government.
Yeah, and let me just say as a plug for Ayn Rand University, I'm teaching an advanced course in persuasion that people can audit, or if you're already an enrolled student and you've reached a certain kind of point in the program, you can take. Keith Lockich's course is still going on and as good as ever. So if people want to check that out, I really encourage you go to university.aynrand.org. And new students also get to take part in the coaching program that I lead. So lots of good resources there. But let's pause for a moment to plug the channel that we are currently on and all the great work they do. So we have some super chats. Mary Aline says, Mark, and has a whole bunch of fun emojis celebrating, and also says writing is hard. Thank you, Mary Aline. And I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce your name. I apologize. K-M-E-T-I-J-A. If anybody has any, if Mark, if you have any guesses on that, I do apologize, but thank you so much for the super chat. Well, I want to move to this part of, to wrap up, which is one thing that I've been really impressed with is the kind of commitment you've shown now that you produced this book and you worked really hard on it. And I think it turned out really well, but I told you that my kind of fatal flaw when it comes to books is my motivation is to write them, and then I really quickly lose interest in promoting them. Not because I don't want them read, because I just don't, I'm more interested in going on to the next project. And it's not, if you create a value, you should really be committing to the whole process of like honoring that value. You've worked really hard and done a lot of the kind of heavy lifting to try to get your book in the right hands. Maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the kinds of activities you've engaged in, because you didn't start with some platform or anything like that. You basically were doing everything from scratch, everything by yourself. I at least, you know, was co-authoring with Yaron Brook and had ARI's marketing arm for my books and so on. Tell me about the process and why you've kind of put really committed to putting in time to promote the book.
Yeah, well, one of the issues was I just didn't have the personal capacity to create a following and do all that kind of gathering of a following ahead of the book publication. And part of that was just the pace of the publication was so fast. But so my publisher, they were going to make an announcement back in January of the book. And they said, oh, what's your Twitter handle? We want to tag you. And I'm like, one moment, please. And I went and registered a Twitter account. And so I am at Muni Finance Guy. That's Muni, M-U-N-I, at Muni Finance Guy. Please follow me on Twitter. And so I've used Twitter to try to gauge what level of communication is going on regarding local government policy and trying to position myself as one of those people that comment in an intelligent way about these things. And I've been trying to spread the word to pro-liberty individuals and groups that are interested in local government policy. I think that's kind of the sweet spot because there aren't many books written.
No, I'm in the middle of the show right now. Landon, this is my son. Landon, I'm actually on internet TV. You need to get out of here until I'm finished. The hazards of working from home. I hope somebody's going to give a super chat for Landon.
There you go. Maybe go even ahead, hit Mark. The join. Maybe even hit the join button on that account.
All right, Mary Elaine says this is inspiring, informative. I'm going to pretend that is a Landon based contribution.
So one of my challenges is, well, nobody's anticipating a book from me. And nobody's really anticipating a book like this. There are not very many books written about book-length pieces written about the challenges of municipal government in administration and finance. And certainly the ones that have been written have not been written from a pro-liberty point of view. And as much as they claim to be reinventing this or reinventing that or really insightful, they really reduce to rationalizing the status quo. So my marketing challenge has been that the probably the people that are most potentially interested aren't expecting a book like this, don't know where to look, don't usually look to see what's come out. So I'm just trying to get out there, and I've made my way onto a few podcasts. And where I'm very well received when I do connect with people. And it is a relatively, unfortunately, it's a small industry of pro-liberty groups and individuals that are interested in local government policy. But that will, at some point soon, I think, work to my advantage, because once I'm known in that group, in that area, then because I'm the only one doing what I'm doing, I'll be a go-to kind of person for analysis on local government, municipal situations. And I mean, that's part of what I tried to do in the book, is be somewhat predictive in terms of, if we keep heading on the path we're on, it's going to lead to this. And that situation has been delayed a bit because there's about $65 billion thrown at local agencies through the federal relief that would be called a bailout if it were given to anybody else. And so that's only put on hold what I think is bubbling in the background, which is quite a bit of local government turmoil. And with inflation the way it is and energy costs rising, and local governments are huge consumers of energy, especially the local utilities, I think we're in for a national crisis. And I'm positioning myself to be ready to address that when it becomes a little more newsworthy. I think part of the problem with the journalism and the news is they wait until the problem is already out there on the table. They're not really looking so far in advance. But some of the pro-liberty individuals and groups are interested in this and are looking ahead. And so they've embraced this and given me a lot of encouragement and support.
Yeah, and I think that one way to put it is that I think if you're really talking about marketing of ideas, it's always a long game. And indeed, there's, like you said, there's reasons why this happened this way with this book. But the ideal is that you've kind of built some kind of audience before you have a book. But I think the fact that you're putting in the effort now, but you have a long range perspective on when it's going to pay off, I think is right. And it's going to put you in a position to succeed long range. So thank you. Another super chat from Mary Elaine. This is inspiring and informative. Christopher, another from Mary Elaine. And then Roland says, go Landon. So you are my new best friend, Roland. Mark, it's been a pleasure you know, working with you, becoming your friend. And I just want to make sure, was I the your first follower on Twitter? I think I might've been.
I think you were my first, and then you got Yaron Brook to follow me. I think he was my second. So,
well, see that it pays to do coaching with me. The municipal financial crisis, make sure to follow Mark on Twitter. Mark, and you have a website too. Could you give out that URL?
Yeah. Munifinanceguy.com. I'm building that. I'm posting my podcast appearances and my book reviews on there. But if for anybody in the US or Canada, help get the word out to your local council members about this book. Or if you know, again, pro-liberty individuals or groups that are engaged in local government policy, please help me get the word out. You can reach out to me through my website or mark@munifinanceguy.com. And I appreciate any and all support. Or if you have questions about the some of this process, just reach out to me.
All right. So that's it for this episode of The Daily Objective. Coming up today, we have at 10 p.m. UK time, Artful Tuesdays with Kirk Barbera and Chikalela, and special guest Jeff Britting on Red Pawn and the early Ayn Rand. So hope everybody checks those out. Mark, thanks again. And tune in tomorrow for what I assume will be another Daily Objective. Take care, everybody.
Thanks, Don.